Welcome. The show is Dynamic Health. You're listening to Co-op Radio. That's Vancouver's Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Today we're going to be interviewing Dr. Will Tuttle. He wrote a book called The World Peace Diet, and he'll be telling us about the invisible connections between our meals and our broad range of problems, the psychological, social, and spiritual, as well as the health and environmental. He'll also tell us how our food choices have far greater ramifications than most of us realize, especially for peace and social justice. Now, Dr. Will Tuttle is an educator, composer, pianist, and writer. Besides being the author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health, he's been an animal rights activist and peace activist and writer for 20 years. He's been a vegan for 27 years. He's the recipient of the Peace Abbey's prestigious Courage of Conscience Award. He's delivered hundreds of lectures and seminars throughout North America for universities, colleges, churches, vegetarian societies, human potential conferences, and environmental organizations. He's on the board of advisors of EarthSave International and writes a bi-monthly column, Food for Thought, for the Veg News magazines. He's a PhD in education from the University of California at Berkeley, focusing on education, intuition, and altruism. He's taught college courses in philosophy, humanities, mythology, creativity, and comparative religion. He's a Zen priest and a Dharma master in the Korean Zen tradition. He's created, as a pianist and a composer, he's created 7 CDs of original piano music and presented concerts throughout North America and Europe. And hopefully by the end of the show, we'll have a chance to listen to some of that music. So welcome, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Great. Thank you so much, Ella. It's great to be with you this afternoon.
Yes, thank you for coming on. So, tell us a little bit about your book.
Sure. The World Peace Diet is, I believe, actually the first book really to come out in our culture that goes into the depth and the breadth, really, of the effects of our food choices on ourselves at a deeper level, our spiritual, psychological, social beings, not only ourselves as individuals, but our culture as well. I think the main thing that my book does, I guess, is that it is really the first book to take our treatment of animals for food and move it from being sort of this thing you don't really talk about, or that's not really a problem because they're just animals, to the center, and show, I believe, that our routine brutalization of literally millions of animals every day for food has huge ramifications for us, and is really one of the main, if not the main, driving forces behind all the problems that we have and that we're not able to solve very effectively at all. I mean, these problems seem to keep getting worse and worse, whatever we're talking about, the social justice problems, environmental sustainability problems, spiritual, and so forth. And I think it's really because we have not faced what really is the invisible core of our culture, which is the mentality of violence towards animals for food and what that breeds, really. It breeds sort of a mentality of elitism and privilege because, you know, certain beings are special, that's us, certain beings just don't matter, that's animals. And that sort of plays out through our whole culture, actually. And it's a mentality also of reductionism, reducing beings to things, to commodities, to mere instruments to be used. And so even if we think that we're working hard for peace and social justice and environmental sustainability and all that, if we're still eating animal foods, we're taking out our wallet and paying people to do things we would never want to do. And that's actually a driving, I think, really the driving force behind our inability to actually be successful and why our quests in many ways are really just merely ironic, because we want peace, but we refuse to give peace to those who are at our mercy. So it goes in, I go into a lot of the different spiritual teachings from around the world and a lot of other things. It's really a lot we can talk about here.
Well, I'd like to hear more about that. Now, a question springs to mind, and that is because people are will say, well, I don't commit violence to animals. I'm removed from it. And then there's also the question that, say there might be Aboriginals or First Nations cultures that will say, we respect the animals before we kill them. We don't abuse them or hurt them, you know, or torture them or do any of this. We pray for them. We give thanks that they gave their lives for us. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you there's a couple of different things there, but basically, I think you know, if people. The first thing you said was that people say they don't do it themselves. You know, they just go in and buy the food in the restaurant or in the grocery store, and that's true. You know, I mean, they're not actually killing the animals themselves, but they're actually paying someone else to do it. Because if we all stopped buying it, it would all stop happening. And, and to the degree that anyone stops buying it, to that degree, it stops happening. So we are actually, when we purchase either the flesh of animals or the fluids of animals, milk or other secretions like eggs, we are the causal agent. We know that, I'm sure, but sometimes people don't think so, to brutality and suffering. And it's unnecessary because we don't need to eat animal flesh or secretions of any kind in order to be healthy. We can get all of the nutritional needs we need, you know, met through plant-based sources. And so that's, I think, an important thing to sort of delve into more deeply. And sometimes people will say, you know, this is something that in the United States anyway, I'm not sure about Canada, but in the United States, the cattle association and the meat, you know, the meat board and all those people, they love to talk about how Indians, you know, eat meat, so therefore it must be a great thing because the Indians are spiritual, so eating meat must be spiritual. And you know, that's basically, I think, totally ridiculous to make that kind of assumption. First of all, we don't need to do that. Anyone can go into a grocery store, you know, pretty much anywhere, and buy totally sustainable, much more sustainable food, plant-based food, and not only is it more sustainable, but it doesn't have the saturated fat and cholesterol, but more importantly, it doesn't have the brutality and misery that killing animals for food always entails. So I don't have any words, really, for, you know, Eskimos or who are, you know, people in the north who are doing...
Certainly.
Hunting or whatever, but we live in a herding culture. This is where animals, and they're not just herded. I mean, these animals are imprisoned in concentration camps that are unbelievably brutal, and you can't make, and to make a connection like that as some way to justify it is just the height of absurdity. You can't justify that kind of brutality and massive castration and the mutilation of animals, the breaking up of their families, the absolute, you know, driving them insane by forcing them into extreme confinement and so forth. That's what we have to really, I think, address in our culture, and this is what our culture is doing.
This is true. Now, I've also had it said to me, I'm vegan as well, that from meat eaters, well, you're killing the plants. You're killing animals, or you kill the plants. What's the difference? Now, you've just described some of the differences, but certainly. Though meat eaters are using that as a justification to say, well, you have to kill something, so
right.
The only difference between you and me, aside from the differences you mentioned, is that I choose to, you know, kill the animal instead of the plant. So
right.
What do you have to say to that?
Well, you know, the thing is, in my book, I don't answer these kinds of questions, actually, till near the end of the book, because... there's so much, I think, that needs to be established. We have to understand, and I mean, I could, you know, right now I could say, which is what I say to someone who says that to me. You know, I only have, you know, 2 minutes to respond or something. I would say, you know, if you obviously are a person who's extremely sensitive and you really care about plants so much. I mean, you really care about plants, obviously, to such a degree that you know you're really bringing this up that they're suffering, and there's really no scientific basis that they do suffer, but I mean, but anyway, if someone says that they think that they suffer, we have then in that case, you for sure you're ethically obligated to be a vegan because you kill far fewer plants by being a vegan than you do by eating animal flesh. Because, I mean, the raising animals for food is the driving force behind deforestation and the absolute destruction of the land, both and the extinction of wild animals too. I mean, it's ranchers are and the greatest warriors against wolves and coyotes and bears and prairie dogs and all the animals that are trying to live here. We're taking away their habitat. It takes about 8 or 9 times as much land to feed a person eating the standard American diet than it does to feed a vegan. So that land is land that's devoted either to grazing, which means, you know, no other animals are allowed there, basically, or for grain production, which is monocultures of corn and soybeans and wheat and oats to feed to imprisoned animals for food, or the decimation of the ocean stocks, or to factory-farmed fish, all of which absolutely destroy living species and take huge amounts of plants, destroy massive amounts of plants. If you have to feed all these plants to animals, you're killing a lot more plants eating animal flesh than you ever would if you ate plants directly. So it's a completely specious argument, and it's just, you know, it's like grasping at a straw to try to justify brutality. And if anyone in a court of law, you know, went and said, well, you know, I mean, plants feel pain just as much as humans, you know, like cutting up a dog or cutting up a lettuce is the same thing. I mean, they'd go right to an institution for the criminally insane. But we know that that's completely absurd. You can't begin to say that. So I think it's really a product of our culture's invisible core, which is that we reduce beings to things, living beings, other mammals, with central nervous systems that we know suffer and feel pain, as well as birds and fish and other vertebrate animals that we know have been granted by the universe, by nature, the capacity to feel pain and to suffer and then enter into social relationships, that have psychological needs and so forth, that, you know, have been given central nervous systems with the capacity to feel pain because they're mobile and they need that, you know, like we do. So when we take these animals and we confine them and destroy their family structures and so forth, we create enormous suffering, and we really are planting seeds. This is one of the most important points, I think, to understand, is that as we sow, so shall we reap. And so whatever we do, it boomerangs and comes back to us. So if I'm paying people, or if I'm engaged in this kind of behavior where I'm you know, basically paying my brothers and sisters to do work that I would never want to do, you know, to stab animals and mutilate and confine and castrate them all day, then I'm basically sowing seeds of misery and suffering. And we see this in our culture, how these seeds come back to us. I have a whole chapter on intelligence, and I think it's important for people to realize that they don't make these choices on their own to eat meat or to eat fish or to eat cheese or eat eggs. These are forced on them as children by their parents and by their doctors and by their ministers and by their school teachers and, you know, by all the institutions of our culture, and it was forced onto our parents, you know, and their...
The beach among the rocks. Leonard had held tight to their jagged edges and swayed with the waves, finally closing his eyes over the last porch light in bliss. But now he can't even kiss her because he thinks about being gay. Leonard is confused because he doesn't know if he makes out with Melinda and then gets a boner, if that will be due to his being excited by her or his recent homosexual thoughts. And then he won't know whether he is gay or straight. And if he's gay, there's technically nothing wrong with that, but it's not very expedient. It'll make it hard to be accepted by the church, plus it'll be awkward on his basketball team because they're, you know, they're very heterosexual, and his life in general will need a huge overhaul because people will constantly be making jokes behind his back. But if Leonard simply gives up...